this is what I've got to tell you that I'm looking at. I'm looking at a photograph of Adam Ant's latest tour coming to the United States. He's doing 37 shows across the United States. He's got a fantastic outfit. I am truly excited. I love Adam Ant, and I love the fact that he's back from his mental illness and everything. And I just wish him Godspeed.
Uh-huh.
And he's got a fantastic stylist, is all I can say. He looks like he's some kind of Pirates of the Caribbean. You know, he's embracing his new romantic roots.
Oh, and, well, that's good. Yeah, I saw him back in the '80s once, and yeah, it was quite a show.
Was it a good show?
He was doing the whole high kicks and hoi hois and all that stuff. So it was.
Now, was it with the Ants or?
I'm trying to think. I think it might have been just post Ant.
Because the thing. This is a very a narrow shaft in the history of rock music,
right.
But I have to say, I think Adam Ant and with the Adam and the Ants and Bow Wow Wow were some of the most exciting kind of spacewalk rock music ever made. And I don't even know the names of those guys, like the drummer, the bass player, the guitar player, who backed up. Who were the Ants?
I believe the main Ant was a guy named Marco Peroni.
Uh huh.
So
and I mean those guys, you know, they were total hot dogs. Like those guys were total players.
Yeah.
And those records are really exciting. Like I actually have, in the past couple of years, recently acquired those records, and they are blisteringly interesting. Like they are that is a band that is on fire, and. And I think it's kind of underappreciated today. I don't think the shelf life on that music lasted very long.
No, yeah, I think you're right about that. Yeah,
I mean they had no artistic credibility, but the truth is the musical, like what they brought to the stage, I suspect was really truly fantastic.
So have you heard Adam's new album?
I haven't. I hope it's good.
It's been getting great reviews, but I haven't heard anything of it. So yeah.
I mean, I know he's had a very rough path. I mean, he's had like 2 decades of sadness.
Yeah.
So, I only wish him the best.
Yeah.
They Might Be Giants actually have a song called XTC versus Adam Ant. And I think the thing that makes me sad about the song is that a lot of people think that it's kind of a diss on Adam Ant. Like it's like saying XTC are good and Adam Ant is bad.
Right.
And when the truth is, it's really about the history of rock music in its most complete sense. Like it could have been called Buddy Holly versus Little Richard. You know?
Uh-huh.
I mean, there is one of the main refrains in the song is there is no right or wrong. And that is really something that I completely believe. I don't think Little Richard is in any way a diminished version of rock music. I think Little Richard brought it to the stage and blew the room away and messed with people's minds and preconceived notions about everything. And that's completely valid. And I feel like Adam Ant was kind of the same kind of, you know, agent of change that Little Richard was.
Some similarity between Little Richard and Adam Ant. The very flamboyant dressers. I saw Little Richard play at the London Wembley Rock and Roll Show in 1972, and he practically got booed off stage because he spent most of his time taking his clothes off and throwing bits into the audience.
Oh, my God. Well, you know, there's that very famous Hail, Hail Rock and Roll movie that he's in right around the same era where he's wearing the mirrored suit.
Right, right, yeah.
If there was a homophobic person in the audience, they were truly blushing at the time.
Yeah, excellent. So are you on the road? Is that why you're in a hotel somewhere?
I am so completely on the road. I'm not exactly even positive where I am. I'm in Charlottesville, Virginia.
All right.
I just played on a Tuesday night for an audience that seemed evenly divided between people who were completely high and really, really happy to see us, and people who were very, very kind of angry drunk and very, very happy to see us. And that is a very, Can you say bifurcated on the radio?
Yes, you can.
It was exciting. It was very exciting, but it was also kind of hard to manage a little bit, because when you get to the quiet songs and there's the guy who's like doing the sort of cowboy hat whoop-de-woo thing and won't shut up, it's a little bit of a stage management that, you know, we are not normally called upon to do.
Yeah,
but
we get quite a bit of that in New Zealand.
The times were high.
The New Zealand crowds, there's always somebody who, or a couple of people who feel the urge to shout things out throughout the shows. And, of course, it's unintelligible. And because of the New Zealand accent, most of the American performers can't understand what they're saying anyway. So.
We can't even understand American drums. I can't imagine there's not a snail's chance in hell that we're going to understand New Zealand drums. But I've got a question for you.
Yeah.
You know, this is a big spacewalk for us, because we haven't played in Australia or New Zealand in at least a decade.
Right.
And it seems like basically by, this is almost like a romance. Like we have completely ignored this territory, not because we wanted to, but there were economic concerns. You know, 9/11 happened, music industry imploded, everything went to hell. And it just never made sense. Basically, They Might Be Giants has not toured Australia or New Zealand since the 90s. We would kind of make our biannual visit with our international touring schedule all through the 90s. And it was really always like a vacation for us. You know, we would go to Japan and Australia, and it would just be like this reward for having toured across the United States in these, you know, Holiday Inn kind of realities that are very, very samey for Americans. And so to get to an exotic place and see all these different things and meet all these new people, and everything about it was just a delightful extra bonus. And that all kind of went away, you know, come the turn of the millennium. And we never really knew when it would come back. And then for, I guess, like, you know, a half dozen years or so, we've been bugging our booking agents saying, like, you know, we'd really like to go back to Australia. Like, we always had a great time there. And to be perfectly honest, I think we felt like there was kind of an affinity for the band that was sort of singular, just I mean, I don't mean to lump New Zealand in with Australia, but, like, Australian audiences are very demonstrative and very, I mean, at the risk of sounding clinical, like very unneurotic. Like they took what we were doing at face value. Like there's an element of humor in what we do. And then there's like a lot of like, there's a certain amount of aggression in what we're doing. Like we are a rock band. And so, you know, unlike a lot of bands of our ilk that are officially friendly, you know, we kind of have a little bit of a New York, like, not so friendly edge. And for whatever reason, that seemed to really complement the Australian rock audience member. Like they just took it in. Like they didn't overanalyze it. They just enjoyed it for what it was. And it seemed like a very natural fit. And we always felt like we were making incredible progress every time we played in Australia or New Zealand. And then all of a sudden that was kind of taken away from us. And now we haven't been back for over a decade. And we just kind of didn't know where we stood. And we had this very generous offer to do the Groove and the Move Festival, which is seems like kind of a strange festival. It's like it's all rural, which is unusual.
Right.
But that's fine. I mean, we've got 30 years of material behind us. Like, we can put together a 40-minute show that's pretty much bulletproof. I mean, it's not like if you can't do a 40-minute festival show after 30 years.
Yeah, there's something wrong.
I think maybe, you know, it's time to, like, ride off in the fog hat bus and just, like, you know, hang up your rock holster. So we were excited about just having the opportunity to get in front of people in Australia. And then they put a bunch of shows on sale in all the major markets in Australia. and they immediately sold out. I mean, this is kind of like the third act in Spinal Tap, where they go like Sex Farm's a hit in Japan. Like, you know, we are suddenly popular. Oh. We're more popular in Australia right now than we've ever been in our entire career.
Well, absence and, does make the heart grow fonder, you know. So
it's. I mean, I'm not going to lie. It's like we are thrilled. We are
cool.
Absolutely over the moon, and you know we're. They added a show in Tasmania. I've never been to Tasmania. I don't know anything about Tasmania. Like, are we going to be eaten alive in Tasmania?
You'll be fine.
It sounds like a fun town. Like, yeah. Everybody says that Hobart knows how to party like nobody else.
Yeah.
So you know, I mean, it's all good. I've got a friend who has a friend who's got a vineyard in Australia, and he's going to give me the whole vineyard tour. It's like supposed to be beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
They make elegant wines, and I just feel like everything about the whole thing is just a blessing. You know, it's like winning the lottery. And now we get to go to New Zealand.
There you
which
go.
I don't think we've been to New Zealand since the mid '90s.
Cool.
So.
So what kind of so long since you've been here? What kind of show are you highlighting stuff from the newest album, or what kind of things are you going to be doing?
Well, we're going to put on a really boring show.
There you go.
No, we're going to stand there, and we're not going to talk to people. Basically, it's a very celebratory show. I think if people bring friends, they won't be disappointed that they're, like, you don't have to know much about the band to enjoy what's going on. It's a very up-tempo show. It's pretty relentlessly up-tempo. I think there's only a couple of, like, truly slow songs. And it's unfortunate that we can't do more low-key songs, because there's some quality stuff there. But the truth is, because we're playing in front of larger audiences, I think it's important that we keep it kind of tight.
Uh-huh.
If we had hits, I guess you'd call it a greatest hits show.
Okay.
I hear that Dr. Worm had some weird afterlife in the region.
Oh, okay.
And that is kind of confusing to us, because like nobody knows that song over here. So it's fascinating to me. I mean, it's completely a cultural UFO that we're just still trying to assimilate ourselves.
And I'm hoping you can tell me a bit about the new album, about Nanobots. Now, it hasn't quite been released here in New Zealand yet. I think it's due in the next couple of weeks. So I haven't heard, I've heard a couple of things on the internet from it, but not a lot.
Well, you know, I mean, there's funny thing, you know, it's our 16th album. So,
yeah.
You know, when you've made 16 albums, things sort of slightly shift. Like when you first start making albums, all the reviews kind of compare you to other people.
Right.
And as you make more and more albums, the praise for your albums become it kind of alters to the highest praise you can get is the critical praise that it's better than the crummy stuff you've been doing before.
Right, sure.
So which gives you kind of mixed feelings, you know, as the writer. I think we've been on a pretty steady. We've been on a kind of a lucky streak in the past, probably since like 2000. I think as things were diminishing with the major label, we were kind of getting a little disheartened because we couldn't really crack the code of what was becoming a very codified commercial alternative radio in the United States. There was a lot of trends that were happening in commercial radio that we just had no affinity for. And so I recently heard a interesting interview with Amy Mann talking about this and how sort of toxic it is to feel like you're not delivering. Like, you know, when you're working with a company, you're kind of promising that you're going to be doing good work.
Right.
And you know, it's not like, you know, obviously people major labels are just this cultural pinata that people beat on, like they're like, you know, the you know, personification of evil. But, you know, I've worked with lots of people who work at major labels, and they're very kind and they're very generous and they want the best for you. And they're trying to give you solid, avuncular advice that's going to help you make your way through the world. But the problem with it is, if you're doing something that's original and you're doing something that's personal, there are going to be times where what you're doing doesn't really sync up with what's happening
right. In
the culture. You know, I mean, I have to tell you, like, we have lived through, you know, They Might Be Giants as a band has lived through the No Wave explosion in New York City,
the new
romantic era, like electronica version 1.0 in the world of like Depeche Mode, the Eurythmics, needless to say, you know, grunge, techno, all the Manchester groups, like the sort of ecstasy groups of the
Happy Mondays,
early 90s. The Happy Mondays. I mean, we were signed when we were on Elektra. The Happy Mondays were signed to Elektra, and they were doing tremendous business as just like a kind of a ecstasy kind of band.
Yeah.
And we had just had chart success in the UK, and we would go over and do interviews, and people would say, like, you have to be influenced by the Happy Mondays. and it's like, I was 32 years old. You know,
right.
I've been listening to rock music since I was 10 years old. I grew up with Alice Cooper and Randy Newman and Elton John and, you know, the Beatles. You know, it's like, I can tell you, I actually did not have to be influenced by the Happy Mondays. Like, the Happy Mondays were a complete, like, you know, blip on the distant, you know, radar screen of my life.
Yeah.
And it seemed, you know, it seemed like something nice, but not that amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, you know, that's the way trends go in the world of, you know, especially in the kind of they eat their own British press thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So we've been up and down the kind of crazy media roller coaster that is pop the music many, many times. And, you know, I guess we're just very excited about really being able to get in front of a bunch of audiences in such a faraway place. I mean, this is very exotic for us. I mean, we're doing two shows.
Yeah.
We're doing two shows in New Zealand.
Yep.
I mean, it's not a lot of, we don't have a lot of chances here to make an impression. So
I'm sure you'll be fine.
Yeah.
Speaking of your audience, I was curious about, you know, the fact that you've done these children's albums and this children's music the past 10 years or so. Do you find that those kids who were listening to you, say, back in 2004, 2005, have grown up and are now showing up at your shows listening to the more, quote-unquote, adult music that you make?
Well, it was not part of an original. It was the most uncalculated thing in the world. We were approached to do a children's record, and it was actually just kind of a way to make a little bit of, like, side income at a time when the band was particularly broke. I mean, one thing about being in a band for 30 years is there's going to come a time when you are feeling a little bit, you need to squirrel away a little cash for the for the kids. And so we were approached about doing this side project for kids, and we really thought, well, you know, it's like, it's either that or a Christmas album or a Halloween album or whatever. So you know, there's a grand tradition in exploitation albums, and you can kind of have fun with it.
Yep.
And it seemed like doing a kids album was more inspiring than the other options. And there are a lot of great, very personal kids projects, like, you know, obviously Dr. Seuss, but also, Maurice Sendak. And I mean, there are a lot of great children's books that are very personal expressions. And it just seemed like if we could figure out a way to translate what we do in adult music into kids music, it could be well received. And so we were actually, it was kind of running parallel to a period where we had toured very heavily through the late 90s, And we'd kind of run aground because we had been on the road every year for 4 years straight. And it was just kind of, we were just kind of running dry on the live circuit. Like we needed to kind of take a moment off because it was turning into a grind. And so we took on the task of doing incidental music for Malcolm in the Middle. We did the theme for Malcolm in the Middle, but we also did, for 2 years, we did all the background music for the show. And it was a very music-forward show. They didn't use a laugh track. They used these music cues that we constructed for them. And these were four-day-a-week, five-day-a-week recording sessions. It was an extremely popular show for Fox. It debuted at number one and stayed at number one for a couple of years. So there was it was very high pressure. And we learned a lot during that period because there are people screaming at us pretty much the entire time.
Right.
And, you know, we learned how to work very quickly, and we learned how to do stuff in kind of a... We just figured out a way to kind of deliver things in a more precise way. Up until then, we'd only been going into the recording studio every couple of years and working on our songs from demos and, you know, kind of doing that very precious, personal,
right.
You know, we're making an album, like writing, recording, like you're an artist, this is your stuff. When you're working in television, it's like you are a wage slave, you are a serf. Why are we talking when you could be finishing the thing that I just told you to do? And so it was a tough job, but at the end of every session day, we would kind of take a little time aside and work on this kid's album, which ended up being the album No. And in a lot of ways, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if you do personal work at the radio station, but I know people listening are familiar with the idea of being at your office and doing personal work. If you're a writer or if you're a graphic designer or an artist working in a studio, there's the thing about, you know, your official work that you're getting paid for, and then there's kind of your after-hours personal work.
Right.
That's just like
mine blurs together.
And, yeah. And so we would just kind of slide in, you know, some songs for the kids' album. And we just kind of worked on this on kind of in the back burner. And I think a lot of the joy of that very first children's album that we did, No, was really much, very much about the joy of doing personal work.
Right.
And it really comes across. And as soon as the record came out, or the album came out, it was just immediately embraced. It was celebrated, and it was a huge hit. It was such a bigger hit than, you know, we've been making albums. It was probably our 10th album or our 9th album. And all of a sudden, all these parents were just like coming out of the woodwork saying, like, this is what children's music should be. And it was really quite delightful and very complimentary, and critics responded and kids responded, and all of a sudden we had a parallel career that was as big as the career we had been working on quite steadfastly for 20 years.
Well,
go ahead. It was not that calculated, you know, I mean, and we've been doing a lot of Australian press, and everybody's like, how about the Wiggles? You know, you guys take it on the Wiggles? And it's like, no. You know, we don't want, you know, it's like, this is not some commercial juggernaut. I mean, we do what we do for, you know, very personal reasons. And if we wanted money, we'd be doing anything but we're doing.
Right.
You know? I mean, we're the Flying Dutchman. You know, we're just going where we're pointed and trying to figure out a way to not be wearing barrels. But
but
it's exciting. The kids' stuff is great. The kids' stuff is a lot of fun to write, and it's just, it's really nice to be part of families' lives. You know, like when you hear the stories that people say about, you know, their kids growing up with your songs, it's really heartwarming, and it's hard not to think you're doing like a good thing in the world.
Well, I should point out to you at this point that one of your songs has become a standby in our family, because instead of singing Happy Birthday at every birthday event now, we sing your song Older, or we should play the recording and everybody sings
along. That is like a whole thing unto itself.
I don't know if anybody else does that, but...
Oh, you are not... trust me, my friend, you are not alone.
Really?
You know, it was absolutely nothing I mean, speaking of the most uncalculated thing in the world, we never thought for a million years it was, you know, it's just a song. And now it is the this universal birthday message that people send to people. I know from, you know, we get the licensing, you know, the BMI things back, and like older has become Happy Birthday to You Part Two. Like, it's crazy.
I thought we were the only ones who did that.
No, you are not. And it's I'm so grateful for that, because holy smokes, it's a hit.
Oh yeah, definitely.
It's so strange.
Well, the whole album is great.
As unlikely as anything possible.
And then we end up singing, you know, like Hovering Sombrero and Bangs throughout the birthday, because we just tend to leave the
CD on. Now you're on your own. Yeah, now you're completely on your own.